Welcome to Take It From Us with host Kent Johns. Real people, real voices, real lives. Discussing mental health, addiction, and disability in the community. Your weekly window to the real world. Welcome to Take It From Us.
Our guest on Take It From Us today has an amazing story to share with us. Josh Coleman was a gun athlete. He had aspirations to run the 800 metres for New Zealand at the Commonwealth Games. A cancer diagnosis changed everything for him. His life was tipped on its head, and as you will hear, his is a story of ultimate survival. Josh has had to beat the odds many times to become the man, the husband, the father he is today. He's had to draw on an inner strength he didn't think he had to not only overcome cancer, but many other hurdles his body decided to throw at him. And soon Josh will get to fulfill his dream of running for New Zealand on the world stage. We hope you draw as much inspiration from Josh's story as we did. Josh, nice to have you on Take It From Us. Welcome into our program.
Hey, thanks very much for having me, Kent. It's a real privilege to have a chat with you.
Over Easter, you got to spend some time at home. Tell us about Greymouth and what it was like for you growing up as a young fella.
Oh, Greymouth's a special place to me, Kent. I mean, it's quintessential New Zealand. I mean, you just expressed the fact that you had a pint and a pie halfway there at Arthur's Pass, you know, and, you know, a lot of people think Greymouth and the West Coast a bit behind the times, but it's a valuable place. You know, it was first established in the early 1800s, and you know, it's a real foundational town, and it's got rough weather, so it's kind of representation of life. You know, work hard, persevere through that tough weather, and you know, the sun shines and it's majestic and beautiful, and I think that's what's a replication of life. You know, sometimes we have those hard times, difficult times, but if we persevere and we're patient and we're persistent, things do come good in the end.
Well, obviously, Josh, unpack your health battles over the years and also the stoicism that you've leant into. But in your darkest times, did you lean into Greymouth as a town and think back to what it meant to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think the town itself, but the people within it, you know, it's really community orientated. And for me, connection is the foundation of health. And when I thought of the people that had my back and were helping me, you know, that really pulled me through my very, very difficult times.
And you had a few, haven't you?
Yeah, I've had quite a few, some would say. It's been very tumultuous up and down, but my life's pretty good now. Still have a lot of issues, but it's a lot better than what it was, mate. I'm not in Melbourne in a hospital bed trying to contemplate taking my life. So, I'm pretty good.
Yeah, I noticed when I was looking at your profile on your website, it almost seems hard to believe that not only are you surviving, but thriving and sounding so optimistic about things, given that you've gone through deep depression, a stem cell transplant, medically induced coma, multiple rounds of chemotherapy, graft versus host disease. I have to be honest with you, I'm not entirely sure what that is, but I'm sure you can tell us. Multiple heart attacks, plus you were living away from home in Australia for 5 years.
Yeah,
and I'm guessing at times your mood was so low that you were thinking of alternate options to living a healthy life. Was that fair?
Absolutely. You really encapsulated it well there, Kent. Yeah, a lot went on, and it's hard to fathom sometimes, you know. And when I talk about my story, I get this kind of prediction error. You know, my life's so good, the sun's shining right now where I'm talking to you, and it's like how I feel. And I've had a lot of storm clouds above my head for a very long time, and I've had to battle with that and try and poke my head above that cloud. And I can assure you, Kent, it's been, excuse the language, but fucking difficult, mate. It really has.
Yeah.
No two ways around that. But I am here. I'm still alive. I'm still breathing. And I found real meaning and purpose within my life through the chaotic times that ensued that you've just clearly stated.
It feels like you're a man that leans into metaphor.
Yeah, I love reading. I'm a big fan of logotherapy, which means healing through meaning, established by Viktor Frankl. He wrote the book Man's Search for Meaning, which had a profound impact on my life when I was first diagnosed with cancer and quite suicidal when I read that book. And he just really, I would say, evoked my human spirit in a way, Kent. Just saw what humans were capable of overcoming and persevering and going through. And I had him in the back of my mind. And as I said at the start of the conversation, you know, connection's the foundation to health, and you don't have to be alive to connect. You can read stories and get inspiration and encouragement from these people that have gone through so much. You know, all you have to do is read World War II and Viktor Frankl. He endured for 3 years in 4 different prisoner of war camps just remarkable, absolutely remarkable. Yet still holding a positive mentality through all that and finding meaning and purpose within his everyday pursuits. Just really held me steadfast together, just pulling me back from the edge of despair, I suppose.
Well, and that was an amazing book. I was recommended that book 10 or 15 years ago, went and bought it straight away. And like you, it had a profound impact on me. And really, he beat the odds and he was able to keep himself going through all of those years in a prisoner of war camp, because if my recollection is correct, he essentially said to himself, they can strip you of your dignity, they can strip you of your clothing, they can take everything from you, but what they can't take is your hope, your optimism, your sense of purpose that I have in my head. They cannot take that from me. And that powered him through. And that book probably has changed a lot of lives, I would suggest, including yours.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was in the top 10 most influential books in the 20th century in America. So it's sold over 9-10 million copies. So I'm sure it's had a profound effect on multiple people. And that quote that you just stated, it's, you know, he states about the last freedom that we have when everything's stripped away. And literally his life was stripped away down to his bare nudity. And that was his attitude. He could still choose his attitude. And that was his conscious choice. So for me, when I was in that negative state and my mind was in turmoil, I could still choose my attitude around it. And I'm not saying I was positive and happy all the time, no way, but I always could pull myself out, reflect on my attitude and choose an attitude to pursue forward. And I know Viktor Frankl had a lot of hard times as well through his 3 years of suffering, but we do have that conscious choice. And as he said as well, a powerful quote, suffering ceases to be suffering once the moment it finds a meaning. And, you know, once we find meaning within our suffering, it comes a lot easier, and we can find meaning through those powerful connections. And that's what Greymouth had for me, those powerful connections, and that was meaning. And I lived for those other people, especially my mum, who was there holding my hand every day.
And at one point, of course, you were a very fine 800-metre runner for New Zealand, and you had aspirations to go to the Commonwealth Games. How did your life change from an aspirational, fit, strong, healthy, young athlete to spending 5 years in Australia and trying to beat the odds?
Yeah, I mean, I think having that running foundation, that physical foundation, really helped me, enable me to be on life support and, you know, have a high heart rate. But seeing my physical self, when I identified myself as a physical, strong man, you know, my work, I was a line mechanic and I worked outside, and I was physically, that was my identity. It was caught up in physical attributes. And all of a sudden, chemo strips you down to a skinny little alien. And I woke up and saw myself skinny and weak, and I was fatigued and tired and in pain. I really couldn't associate myself with the person who I previously was, and I didn't know who I was. I lost all purpose. I lost all meaning. And my mind became quite confused, because I thought this could potentially be me forever. And that's when my thought process completely changed, and I went against myself, and I couldn't control those thoughts. And I thought about really contemplating taking my life. And it was a near attempt when I was on the balcony outside of a place called Rānui House. And I remember it vividly. It was a tough day. My cancer was out of control. My mind was out of control. And I woke up and I saw myself and I was just screaming, you know, what's going on? And I couldn't control it. So the one thing I could control, at that time I hadn't read Viktor Frankl's book. I lost complete sight of my attitude. So my control was taking my life. And I went to the balcony, put one foot over, and then the wind hit my face and just serendipitously turned around and I saw my mum's cup of tea there. She'd gone out and I felt her love come to me, and that pulled me back. And that was the meaning potential that pulled me back from ultimately making a life-ending decision, Ken. But yeah, it was that connection to my mum that just pulled me back in that sporadic moment.
Have you told her that?
Yeah, she knows it very well. I mean, she knows how much I love her. She knows the story, and she knows how much her love and her care and kind kinship and her warmth has just helped me through my adversities. She's been a big pillar in my life, Kent.
Yeah, I lost my mum recently to dementia, and I had the real honour and privilege of speaking at her funeral, and my sentiments were pretty much what you've just said. And I'm thinking, man, you know, I'm 47, and okay, if I live to a ripe old age of 100, Mum would have only been around for less than half of that. But what a profound impact that she made for me. And I think about all of the decisions she helped me make, Josh, some of the dumb shit I used to do and unsure about, do I do it this way? Do I do it that way? Just to be able to lean into her wisdom and her knowledge. And I know not everyone gets a parent like that, but I can imagine that your mum has been just a rock for you and someone that I'm sure in your darkest moments you've really spoken to and perhaps sought out her wisdom.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, not even her wisdom too, Kent. I mean, it's just your presence. And we've just had a wee girl. The mother and daughter or child relationship is inseparable. It really is. And sometimes she just didn't have the words, but she just had a hand to hold, Kent. And that meant so much. And we talk about depression and suicide and things like that, and people don't know what to say or do. But I think it's the ability just to turn up, just to be in their presence and know that you're there for them. Because sometimes we just don't have the words. And my mum definitely didn't have the words, but she had love, and it was unconditional, and it was always there. And she just held it tight with her hand, with her hugs, with her kisses, and that physical touch.
Yeah, and having just recently been through that grieving process myself, I think I've come to really appreciate that point. Yeah. Is that not everyone knows what to say. You know that people feel sorry for you, they feel sad for you, and that's sympathy. But really just reaching out and acknowledging, hey, I don't know what to say. Maybe the text message I just sent to you was really clumsy, but just the fact that I'm thinking of you is real empathy. And I was actually blown away that even the simplest messages of support, hey man, hope you're going well, thinking of you and the family, shit man, they meant a lot, right? They meant a lot. And I've sent so many of those messages myself over the years thinking, oh, I don't really know what to say, but I've got to come up with something. But you're just not sure how that will land at the other end. And you've got to figure that it's a good thing just that for your friends to know, or in your case, for you to know that you've got people just there for you, even if they don't know how they should act and what they should be saying.
Yeah. I mean, because what's the right thing to say in such a tragic situation? What is the right thing to say? Nobody really knows. No one knows. However, you know, I had a good friend. She used to just write me letters, and I'd look forward to these letters just topping up, and she might have a funny joke in that. And I had a good friend that would just turn up called Hamish, and he'd just sit there, and I'd fall asleep while I was getting chemo, and I'd wake up and he's still there. No words were spoken, but he was still there. So it's that association of I'm here, I'm present, I don't know what to say, and that's okay. But if you need me, I'll be here. You know, I've just had a coffee with a lady called Sarah, and she worked for Canteen at the time. And I've just told you that story about taking my life. And that's when I wanted to reach out for help, because prior to that, I turned everybody away, all the psychologists, all the counselors, because I didn't want that stuff. You know, I'm a man, I can deal with this. This is the way I'm going. I've just caught up with her. I haven't seen her in 6 to 7 years. And she was the one I reached out to. The reason why is because regardless I said, go away, I don't want your help, she kept turning up. So that built trust. So if we keep turning up for that individual and we don't have the words to say, but we turn up, we smile, we're present, it builds trust. And when we're in despair, you know, all of a sudden we know who we can turn to. We know who we can call. And I called up Sarah and she got me a counselor, a psychologist to talk to.
You've been through so much, as we've just referenced a few minutes ago.
Mm.
What was the worst of it?
It's really hard to pinpoint. I think all of it, the whole lot, to be honest, but I think being in Melbourne, to be fair, if I'm going deep here, I mean, I suffered tremendous pain with trigeminal neuralgia, but I had a lot of people around me then, and I was in an environment that I knew that was physically tough. But being in Melbourne by myself with no friends, when I was having chest pain and I was lying on the street curb, clutching my chest, my body was locking up. I'd just recently broken up with a girlfriend, and I was really, really struggling and really battling physically, mentally, and spiritually, all three aspects. But it was three things that really held me together. That was Viktor Frankl, my belief in God, and being able to regulate my breath in that moment, because they were one things that I could do to kind of take my attention away from the pain that I was in, if that makes sense.
And the pain was pretty bad, eh?
Oh, It's hard to describe. I mean, everything in my body was getting attacked by this new transplant. So my immune system came from somebody else. So my whole new immune system, my DNA had changed, was attacking my body. So that's the graft-versus host disease we're talking about. So my body was kind of gluing itself together, essentially, and just going down to the supermarket, which is only 150, 200 meters away, was like walking an ultra marathon, Kent. It was extremely difficult. My eyes felt like they had razor blades in them. My mouth was extremely dry, and I felt like I was in the desert, and my body would just lock up. I've had to sit down. I've got pain in my chest, and I was very suicidal, very depressed as well, and I'd just go home and just lie down, exhausted, completely exhausted, going, how can I make it through the next day? But it was just those small things of deep appreciation, love, hope, and gratitude for those fundamental relationships that I'd established on the coast and throughout my journey as well, because I met a lot of people that had passed away. And I thought, you've got to live for them. You've got to live for them. They're not here. You know, I had a good friend, Adam Newcomb, a good mate of mine. He lived across the road. He passed away from bowel cancer as well. And he passed away when I was in Melbourne. I flew back to speak at his funeral, flew back, and you know, it was those people that didn't have that opportunity to feel the pain that I'm feeling, because that gave me a reference that I was still alive, that I'm still here, that I'm still breathing. Something good will come. Something will become good will come, just like Viktor Frankl. So those connections, those profound connections, really held me together, Kent, in those difficult times, especially in Melbourne.
Was the stem cell transplant what turned things around for you? That saved your life?
Yeah, it saved my life, and then it started killing me as well at the same time. So just to explain it, our immune system is derived from small cells in our bone marrow called hematopoietic stem cells, another factory of our cells to make all our white blood cells, red blood cells, and platelets. So mine had a genetic mutation there, and it was not functioning properly, so they had to be replaced. So they'd wipe me up with high-dose radiation, high-toxic chemotherapy. It's like Nagasaki when they're dropping the atomic bomb on Japan, just obliterating everything. That's what it's like. It's tough treatment. And then they have to bring in new stem cells. And my donor was from Germany. We can talk a bit more about that later. She was from Germany. She was a young girl. So it was a mismatch. It was a bit of a cross match there. So it wasn't an exact match due to my tissue. And then from that, you can get graft versus host disease, which is called GVHD. So basically, my whole new immune system, my blood DNA had changed, as I said, was going to attack every part of my body. You know, my eyes, my mouth, my organs, my skin. But it specifically attacked my stomach, my skin, my eyes and mouth. And I got that GVHD and the immunosuppressants, what they gave me. And steroids weren't really working, so that's why I had to get sent to Melbourne at the time. There were only two New Zealanders at the time getting this treatment. It's quite specialised treatment, and that's why I got sent to Melbourne to help downregulate this overactive immune system.
And how long ago was this?
I got sent there in 2016, and I was there for 5 years, yeah. Yeah.
Without ever being allowed back here?
No, I was allowed back after about maybe 18 months. Initially, Kent, I was supposed to be there for 6 months. So they said, oh, you're going to go over there for 6 months, live there for 6 months, and you should be under control. We'll have you on low-dose immunosuppressants and you'll be good to go. But my body didn't play that game. It started working quite well in the first few weeks, but unfortunately, nothing's easy with me. And I had a massive heart attack. And I ended up having 12 heart attacks, which put me in the Melbourne hospital in the cardiac unit for 24 days, deciding what they would do with me, give me a heart bypass or stent my left main artery. I ended up stenting my left main, but the GVHD got out of control and flared up again and started attacking me, and I had to get back on intensive treatment, where I was getting treatment at Peter McCullum Cancer Centre. So yeah, I was playing the game of getting better, then getting a flare up, getting better, and then having a flare up. So I was there for about 18 months. And then I started flying back and forth, and then I'd have an issue. Then I'd have to stay back over there for 6 months. Then I'd fly back and forth. Another issue would arise, and I'd stay back there again for another time.
Have any scientists or researchers tried to figure out what's so special about you and your body as to how you've successfully got through everything?
I don't know. I recently did a 6-part talk, a nationwide talk for the Blood and Leukemia Foundation, and I was lucky enough to talk to most hematologists around New Zealand, and they all said, you know, GVHD is the hardest thing to treat. They honestly don't know how this treatment in Melbourne actually works, what it actually does. But it does work in some regards. Obviously, it doesn't work for some people, but it does. It does help some people. So they don't know the answers to it. However, I believe once my mental state was changed, my immune state changed. There's this thing called immunoception developed by Aisha Rolls. You know, it's about the placebo effect in a way. If you're thinking more positively and you've got purpose and meaning in your life, something you're actively pursuing, your immune system gets enhanced by the positive feelings within your mind. So yeah, that's called immunoception. So that's what I think helped me. Not saying it's a cure or anything like that, but I do believe that played a significant part once I changed my attitude and I could see a positive outlook and I was having meaning and purpose within my life.
And it makes sense, doesn't it? And I think I've heard scientists talk about this before, that if you're going through trauma and if you're going through anything that requires surgery or a cancer or whatever it might be, that however, it's very hard to measure, but if the survival rates are increased through positive thought, being optimistic, maybe being hopeful, feeling some form of gratitude, things like that, it sounds like you really leaned into that.
Yeah, I did. And I think, I don't know if you've heard of the Grant study. It's the longest study that's been recorded. It was started in Harvard University in 1942, still ongoing right now. And the main correlation, what they plucked from the study, was kind of two things I really talk about. And that was one, having strong, meaningful connections, strong relationships. So knowing people had your back, that you were part of something bigger. And two was having a positive outlook, that you had a meaning to fulfill in your life, that you had purpose and a drive to work towards. So they were two main attributes really that constituted someone to live a long, happy life. And that was a better marker of health than what your cholesterol levels were. So I do believe how important connections are and the positive outlook.
What you're saying is bang on, that, you know, if you're wanting to make great change for yourself and you see a brighter, optimistic future for yourself, with particularly around your health, you can't wallow in self-pity for very long. It's okay. I liken it to a cave, but to use one of your metaphors, you know, duck into a cave, have a look around, is there anything useful, and then get the hell out. Whereas our path to a better self can be out meandering as long as you want it to be out in the sunshine. But that has to come from optimism and hope and feeling like, shit, man, I can do this, because otherwise we can't change.
Yeah, I do agree with that too. I absolutely do. But, you know, sometimes we get in that cave, but it's hard to get out, but we need that helping hand. And that's why those connections are so key, because I believe courage comes from encouragement. And the more people wrapped around me, giving them those encouraging words, not that they didn't throw the rope, they just gave me the words, you've got this, you know, we're here. And that pulled me out of that darkness. And once I was out of that darkness, I could see a bit more clearly. It's pretty opaque, obviously, but still I could see something and I felt something. So that gave me that kind of attitudinal change there, that I could see something and I had a meaning to fulfill, which was get myself back on my feet the best I could to start establishing a positive life for me, you know, to get back into the workforce. That was my first goal, to get a job again, whatever it might be. And my first job, Kent, was actually working with autistic kids. Who would have thought, you know, a line mechanic, I was working with autistic kids 2 days a week. That was 16 hours a week, you know. And that was my first step back into the workforce. And then I was, you know, you got to use those physical attributes. And I was at the gym, you know, I had a whole heap of different holistic outlooks on trying to establish my health and well-being, which enabled me to get myself back on my feet, get back myself in the workforce. And then all of a sudden that led into another full-time job and a great company that really supported me. It was still helped me going back and forth to Melbourne. And, you know, that was a full-time job at the time. And then I met my wife, you know, all from that. So a remarkable thing when you're patient, when you're persistent, when you've got those connections, when you can kind of see something. You might not understand what it is, but you can see something or feel something. You've got meaning in that moment. Just wake up for that meaning. Find that meaning, whatever it may be. It might be just putting your shoes under the bed or cleaning your room or something small like that. Just doing something small leads into something bigger.
And something bigger, as far as meaning goes, is becoming a parent.
Mm.
Right? How's fatherhood impacted you?
Oh, Kent, what a privilege that is. I mean, yeah, I might get a bit emotional here. Yeah, I mean, you know, that was 12 years ago when I thought about taking my life, and even in Melbourne too, Kent. But to have this wee girl who was on IVF for a very long time, and, you know, I was going to take my life, and you got the ability to give life. I mean, I don't think there's more greater meaning in my life than what she's given me, and just seeing the girl. Just seeing the girl who she's growing into, and her development, and me trying to create confidence in her and establish some good values, that when she gets into her difficult times, that she's got something to fall back on, that and I have the privilege of kind of just guiding her through that process. And I just see such potential in her, and such life and such vitality, Kent, and it's just such an honor to watch and grow and nurture. It really is, mate. Yeah.
I've got two little kids, and you don't want them to grow up because you want them to stay small, stay and cuddly, and you worry about how the world might treat them as they grow older. But if life was to stand still, and you'd never see them develop into the people that you'd love them to develop into, more for themselves, of course, than for you. But my son's 6, and sometimes I think, man, I wish he was just 1 or 2 years old again, because he was so cute. But he couldn't play cards with me, or Cluedo, or go and have a game of cricket, or whatever it might be, if he was only 2. So it's neat that he's 6, and then he'll be 10 one day, and I'll think, oh, I remember when he was 6. But to see your kids grow up is really, really something else, isn't it? And I guess you and I are just a couple of guys talking about our kids. But they're special to us, right?
They're special to us, and they're unique to you, and they're unique to me. But I think every age has the extreme positives and extreme negatives. Such, you know, she's 2.5.
That's true.
And I can tell you, you'd understand this more than me, mate. You've got 2 there. I've got 1, but that deprived sleep's not good. It pulls the frustration levels up, and I'm thinking about, man, I wish my daughter was 10 and she could sleep by herself and that. But hey, it's just appreciating those moments that we have in front of us, because I understand that it can be taken away in the blink of an eye, you know, it can be. And it's just stepping back and saying, hey, if I was to die tomorrow, would I be this angry? Would I be this frustrated when you're looking at this beautiful wee girl in front of you? So it's just taking that breath, simplifying it, and saying, hey, it's okay. Regulate yourself. Look at this girl. She just shines perspective on you sometimes.
You've got such an inspiring story, Josh, and have turned that into a book, and you do a lot of motivational speaking and workshops and everything else, which takes vulnerability. Just to be sitting there telling us your story today needs vulnerability. And I believe that vulnerability builds trust. And a lot of Kiwi men struggle just to open up just that little bit to talk about themselves, and that they can become leaders. Has that come natural to you?
No, definitely not. I think I always had a sensitivity side to me when I was growing up as a kid, but obviously it's suppressed when you get into the workforce a bit, because being a man is obviously, you know, you're busy, you work hard, you're tough, you don't talk about your emotions, you just get it done, mate, and rip out a few people along the way, which is all good. It provides some value to life, but there's another side to it, Kent, and that's the emotional side. And I found that through my cancer. I mean, I connected with my dad. I didn't really have much of a relationship. I mean, he was my father for sure, but a real emotional one. And I saw him cry for the first time in my life. And then we had a deep, honest, meaningful connection. He spoke about his childhood, and I could understand the way he was. So it provides, as you said, that trust aspect, that vulnerability. I could see a person for who they were. And I think that's the greatest courage in life, when we open up and we see someone for who they are. They're embracing those tears because they have suffered. They have seen something, and it's out there, and you can connect with that. Because when I was a fast, fit, healthy runner on top of my game, people gave me pats on the back. They gave me high fives. But I can tell you, when I was in deep, deep despair and in pain, people looked me in the eye and fucking hugged me, man. They hugged me. And that was more meaningful than being that fast runner, because I could see the individual for themselves, that they'd been through something in their life as well. And that was the connection that we created.
Well, people would have loved to have seen you do well as a runner, but they care about you, the person. And you've given them an opportunity to actually show through your ups and downs the chance to show what it is that you mean to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think with the pain that I talk about, you know, the struggles that I have, people can associate to it in some small way. I mean, it is my story, but everyone's got their story, but someone can associate themselves to the pain, whether it's being grateful for a child and having those moments with it, whether it's someone passing away from cancer or something, you know, someone can connect with that and come up to me and have those meaningful conversations. And I've had multiple, and it just opens up a dialogue for another person to connect. And that connection, as we said, creates that courage to continue and pulls that people out of the cave a little bit. It might be a bit opaque, as we said, but at least they can start to see something because they've provided that connection, and that's meaningful and that's powerful.
Do you still have to manage pain?
I do indeed. Yeah, I do. I don't take any pain medication because I've been on too much medication. But for me, I'm consistently in an ice bath or an outside cold shower in the morning. That really helps with that analgesic effect, you know, pain relief. Plus, I'm a breath science practitioner, so my breathing helps regulate my pain threshold, helps regulate my nervous system. And also, we spoke about this in depth about it, my mindset as well. I kind of associate the pain to something else rather than kind of dwindling in the pain for too long. But yeah, I do struggle with pain a lot. Yeah.
But the breath work helps, the cold therapy helps.
The cold therapy, the breath work, and the mental mindset around the pain as well, what I'm associating the pain to. Yeah, that all helps, all three things. Absolutely.
Will you have to live with pain for the rest of your life?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think I will, but I call it discomfort now. It's just chronic discomfort. That's fine. I've been in a lot worse, and I've got that reference point, and I've got tools in my arsenal to mediate that pain. Yeah.
Does movement help?
Movement helps for sure, but it can have a consequence if I move too much, mate. I tried to push the buttons a bit too much last year and run this 10K race, and it just pushed me back. So I've kind of found my threshold, you know. You got to cross the line to know where it's at, and I've crossed the line so I can kind of balance my movement activity, if you like, to not exacerbate myself too much when my body starts pushing back on me and I have to go back into hospital.
You've got something quite significant for yourself coming up, perhaps even a momentous occasion and moment for you in August this year. When you head off to the World Transplant Games in Dresden, Germany.
Keen.
What about this event is so important for you?
Oh, mate, I mean, it's so much meaning behind it. I mean, it's hard to fathom, really. So I was, you know, one of New Zealand's fast stag 100 metre runners. I wanted to represent New Zealand at the Commonwealth Games at the 800 metres. And obviously that door had shut on me, completely shut. My mind went into chaos. Thought my life had ended, wanted to take my life, and went through the journey that we've just spoken about. And I never thought I'd be able to achieve this goal of representing New Zealand in the 800 metres, Kent. And all of a sudden, when I was in Melbourne, the professor who was treating me said, "Hey, have you heard of this thing called the World Transplant Games?" I hadn't. I looked it up and I thought, "Oh, that's pretty cool." But probably a year after that, I looked it up again and I thought, "Holy smokes, it's in Dresden in 2025. You know, in the same place where my stem cells were collected from, where a young girl donated her stem cells in Dresden in Germany. So I thought, that's really meaningful. I have to attend. I have to go. So this year in August, as you said, you know, it's happening. I'm going to don the silver fern in the 800 meters, my prized event, and fulfill the dream that I had as a kid, man. And, you know, it just goes to show that when one door shuts and you think it's all gone, if you're patient, if you're persistent, and you just persevere through that hard times, connect with those individuals, you know, go through it, another door will open that's 3 times, 10 times bigger than what you perceived it to be, than what you ever perceived it to be. And that's what's happened to me. And it's even more meaningful than going to the Commonwealth Games. It's so special, you know. It's a celebration of life. I get to be around the people that have had transplants. My donor will hopefully be there with me, and it will be just an epic time, a very special time. So yeah, 14 years later from my first diagnosis to now, you know, the dream, I thought I was dead and I thought the dream was dead, but the dream's back alive, and I'm still alive and I'm still breathing, Kent. So we've still got those opportunities and doors still keep opening.
What do you think might be the most emotional or spiritually important moment for you when you're there?
I think if my donor's willing to come to the opening ceremony, I think that would be the most important thing for me. I think this is the ultimate thank you to the people that have supported me, from my medical staff to my friends to my family, and specifically my donor as well. To have that moment of saying, hey, your life is back and it's better than what you've ever had. You've got more in it than what you could ever perceive, you know. And it's been a whole heap of people that have helped me. And for me, I want to thank everybody that's helped me, but words can't justify it. So I kind of justify it through my actions by living a wholesome, meaningful, purposeful life full of gratitude and love and appreciation. And I try and incorporate that into my life every day, because it's still hard, Ken. It's still hard. But if I can do that through my actions and turn up and go to Dresden and fulfill that dream, it just shows myself and other people that when things are taken away, it can always come back in a completely different light. So the most meaningful thing about it will be walking into the stadium with her, running that 800 meters, crossing that line, smiling on my face saying, hey, man, you fucking did it.
Sorry for words.
Oh, no, not at all. Good place to leave our chat, because something for you to look forward to. I know how important that will be, and we hope you let us know how that moment is for you.
I will indeed, Kent. I will. I mean, that moment's for everybody. It's for everybody. I mean, for sure I'm turning up, but my story is just another story. I'm just a different person in a multiple stories, that when you go through hard times, good things can happen to people, and we can't give up on ourselves. We just can't give up on ourselves. And I know how tough life can be. I really do. And for the people that are struggling out there right now, you know, reach out to someone, close your eyes, find someone that you've connected with that you love so much, because that's the power. They don't have to physically be there with you. It might be a special moment. You might not have a mother like I did, but I know that someone's had someone come into their life that's provided meaning and value in their life. And that's love, man. So if someone is struggling, close those eyes and think of that person and bring them close to your heart and hug them tight and let that be the guide, because your life will get better, even though it seems so drastic right now. And for me, that's just my story, mate. That's what this transplant game shows.
We've all got a story. Yours is unique and profound, and we thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Hey, thank you so much, Kenton. Thanks for providing me a platform to be able to speak and share the story too. So thank you so much. It's nice to converse with you.
Have a great time. Enjoy yourself in Germany. Run well. Do you have time? You got a personal best that you want to beat?
Oh, Ken, it's funny. I got asked that from Sarah today. There is a time. My fastest time is 1 minute 50 seconds. So if I could double that, I think that's 3 minutes 40 seconds. Oh, that would be awesome. If I can hit 3:40, I think that would be really, really cool. So we'll see how we go.
Great. Hey, all the very best, Josh. Thanks a lot.
Hey, thanks, Kent. Cheers, mate.
Take It From Us is produced by Karen Murphy, and I am your host, Kent Johns. Please get in touch with us on Facebook. We'd love to hear from you.
You're listening to Take It From Us. My story, your story, our story.